Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Back to another episode. This week we're going to be taking a look at District 9, Neil Blomkamp's 2009 sci-fi film. So background for District 9, this existed first as a short that Blomkamp filmed called Alive in Joburg. And basically the short was the same subject. Pretty much some of the shots are very similar. He may have even used one or two shots from Alive in Joburg and dispersed. So Alive in Joburg was a short, as I said, but dealing with the same subject. On the producing side, Peter Jackson was involved with this film, and he planned to produce a film adaptation based on the Halo video game franchise with first-time director Neil Blomkamp due to Blomkamp's Alive in Joburg film. So there was a lack of financing, so they kind of came together creatively. Jackson, I think, and Philip Boyens or some other of Jackson's writer, filmmaker, co-creators with Blomkamp, and they spent a bunch of time on Halo, writing it and you know, storyboarding and all this kind of stuff. So at some point, the funding dried up, and the adaptation was based on hold. At this point, Jackson and Blomkamp then discovered what kind of alternative projects they should do. Since they were kind of, you know, knee-deep in a film, they just kind of wanted to continue, but to maybe pick another subject. And so they discussed his Alive in Joburg, and that was kind of what happened. And Blomkamp had previously, before Alive in Joburg, directed commercials and some, I think, other short films. So District 9 is his very first feature film. Blomkamp co-wrote the script with a woman named Terry Tatchell, who I think is his partner, and chose to film in South Africa, where he was born. So in District 9, Tatchell and Blomkamp return to the world, again, described in his short film Alive in Joburg, choosing characters, moments, and concepts that they found interesting, as well as the documentary style that Alive in Joburg was about, with stage interviews, so on and so forth. So definitely fleshing it out to get to a feature length. And it was shot on location in Chiwelo, Soweto, during a time of violent unrest in South Africa, involving clashes between native South Africans and Africans born in other countries. The location that portrays District 9 is in itself was a fact a real impoverished neighborhood from which people were being forcibly relocated to government subsidized housing. So this film is quite a metaphor in itself, and it's brilliant in that way. And yet, it's even filming what you're seeing is sort of metaphorically going on, you know, at the same time. So pretty amazing to think about. The film features many weapons and vehicles produced by the South African arms industry, including the R5 and Vector CR-21 assault rifles. Those really cool white plastic rifles. The armored personnel carriers that you see are actual. So a lot of the things you're seeing here, these interesting fighting vehicles, are all real vehicles and weapons that are used by the South African armed forces. And a last bit, Blomkamp said no single film influenced District 9, but he cited the 1980s, quote, hardcore sci-fi slash action films such as Alien, Aliens, The Terminator, T2, Predator, and RoboCop as subconscious influences. So pretty decent pedigree there. The director said, I don't know whether the film has that feeling or not for the audience, but I wanted it to have that harsh 1980s kind of vibe. So let's jump into District 9. We start with the character of Vikas Vandermeer, who played by Sharlto Copley, who's a pretty amazing actor in his own right. And we're very much, this film starts, for the first third, I would say, starts and holds the documentary format. And then at some point, when the story starts to really break, there are things that are happening in the story that are not directly in the documentary. The film starts to become a hybrid of feature and documentary. But from the beginning, it's pretty much a documentary. And we see Vikas sitting there fiddling with his mic, very geeky in a sweater vest. This just mid-level corporate manager, very uncertain, kind of a kind of a dick, and as we'll get to find out soon. So he works for a company called Multinational United, a great cinema corporation title, if ever there was one. And they're working with the South African Department of Alien Affairs, which we're going to see their purpose very soon. We cut then right to this first wonderful shot of the alien mothership hovering motionless over Johannesburg, which is just, it really looks great. It's a little dirty kind of in the screen, but it just, you know, because you're looking at it through the lens of like a documentary, it's as if someone's really shooting it with a handheld or over-the-shoulder camera. It looks really good. And we have a narrator quite purposely telling us exactly what the writers probably found clever, that the ship, as in most, you know, sci-fi novels and movies, right, didn't appear over London or New York City or Los Angeles, but Johannesburg, South Africa. And now the story is very straightforwardly told to us. The ship arrived and it didn't open. And humans had to kind of go up to the ship and cut their way in after 3 months, which is a bit of a logic flaw because for the rest of the film, it's almost, you get the sense that humans can't get into the ship because so if they cut their way in and got in, there would be teams and teams of you know, scientists from probably all over the world on the ship constantly taking it apart, trying to reverse engineer it, and that doesn't happen. So I thought it was one little bit of a logic flaw in the film. So we see kind of archival footage of this moment, and it's very grainy and fuzzy, which is great. And they've discovered these creatures whom are derogatorily called prawns because they kind of look like overgrown shrimp. They're malnourished, emaciated in the hold of the ship. And the backstory is a bit like this is kind of the refugees, as the, you know, the operators of the ship seem to have either died or fled, or they were part of an even larger mothership. And these are kind of like the lower deck refugees, as it were, that were left on the ship kind of to their fate. So maybe the ship was malfunctioning and, you know, kind of the masters of the ship got off and they left sort of these workers and lower caste members of the society to their fate, which is genius. I mean, what a delightfully refreshing take on alien invasions and science fiction. You know, it's not the top of the cream of the crop or the leaders versus the leaders. These are kind of the worker drones, you know, the blue collar aliens of their society that are here. So great, great opening idea. We go right to the temporary refugee camp that's been set up, and we get a first quick look at the prawns. There are 1 million of them that were rescued from the hold of their ship. The refugee camp has basically become a militarized and walled-in slum, which has been dubbed District 9. And then we see all these great documentary shots of aliens selling raw meat and chopping it, and just a grimy, grungy look of the camp, which is incredibly realistic. And, you know, right away, this film was done in 2009. How incredibly prescient it was when we're talking about refugee crisis in Europe now and Syria, right? My God, you can watch this today, and it's so incredibly relevant. It still very much holds up as a really good sci-fi action film. And at the same time, the meat of the allegory that's going on here is probably more applicable now than it was when it was made. So I find that really, really impressive. There's one little detail that we see, that one some grainy shot of the ship. The only other activity that happened was a small piece of the larger ship fell, and they lost sight of it and disappeared, and they don't know what happened to it. So that, of course, will come into play much later on in the story, but that's a seed for something that's going to happen later. The main of the story takes place 20 years later after this arrival, and we're in the thick of District 9, and there are riots and unrest that are going on, and they're showing this as if it's a news story that's on the news, and it's done incredibly realistically. They shoot the aliens very matter-of-factly in the frame as if they were a matter of course, which I think the unconsciousness which with the aliens are framed in the screen makes them that much more realistic seeming to me, because they're not framed in this way where the filmmaker's saying, hey, look, aliens. It's done once, briefly. There's one brief shot of an alien that's close up near the foreground of the film. But other than that, the very matter-of-factness that this has done is just enhances the effect of the movie. You know, as a longtime sci-fi fan, I've never seen aliens shot in this way before, in this matter-of-fact way. And we're hearing commentary voiceover that could have been taken from like a BBC or PBS show on Syrian refugees, right? It's very chilling describing that, you know, there's nowhere for these aliens to go, really, and there's poverty in the slum, and the military has to take control, and now the aliens are rioting at some point, and they become criminals. Like, it's what an incredible opening, you know? It's really, really fascinating and brilliant. The genesis of the story is that the government of South Africa, the Department of Alien Affairs has decided to move District 9 out of Johannesburg and relocate it much farther from the city. And we get a brief montage of different clips of seemingly real Johannesburg inhabitants saying, you know, we just don't want them around. Or, you know, they're disgusting and dirty. We don't want, I mean, you know, it could be ripped from the headlines today. It's incredible. So they hire this company, Multinational United, to do the job of relocation. One of the higher ups in the company is Wickes's father-in-law. So he's given the lead in this thing. He's put in charge. And just the father-in-law wants to give the daughter's husband a little visibility, right? Basically, what he has to do, these kind of dubious legalities of actually relocating them, which I think the film is brilliant to go into the details of this, that they have to get each of the aliens to sign this relocation form that allows MMU to evict them from the premises. So this is kind of setting up the conflict of the character going into District 9. And then at some point now, we fast forward a little bit and hear from his wife about, I guess, after the whole movie, this has all been over, like, oh, you know, all of his things were taken during the investigation. So we're kind of given this frame now, right in the beginning, that things didn't go very well. What a startling opening. I mean, an incredible opening. And I feel it's very new for sci-fi, this documentary style, foreign location, realistic to the point of it being almost unnerving and very difficult to watch. Actually, a lot of District 9. It's one of these films, and I'll get into this when I summarize, but it's hard to watch because it's a little too close to home. It's a little unnerving at points, but it is an incredible opening, and boy, they throw you right into the thick of things. And as I've said in many podcasts in the past, the more realistic you make your fantastic worlds, not that they have to look like, you know, real places, but the more realism where you're looking at something on screen and you're like, oh, that's a place that if I walked out my door and I stepped into it, I wouldn't be that taken aback by it. There might be some things that I might have to get used to, but, you know, making your imaginary worlds tactile and very believable is such a great grounding when you're going to take these flights of fancy to come, you know. And I think District 9, some of the best of that I've seen in a long, long time. I mean, boy, it's gritty, it's grainy, it's... The documentary style is very assured, and it just feels like it was ripped from today's headlines. So great, great opening. A little bit of now our character. The character of Vickers is great because, you know, he really does have a very large arc. He starts out as kind of a dick and a putz and very cruel, and, you know, it's unnervingly how casually cruel he is. But boy, what a circle that he comes around to by the end. And so there's this moment we see what kind of a putz he is, where he notices one of the guys in the military has too many ammunition clips. And so the main, who's going to be the main bad guy in this film, Kubis is his name, the leader of the military. And so he says, hey, you know, your men have too many clips and it's not very efficient. And the guy flips out on him and like pushes him and the mic falls off. And he's like, F you and stay out of my effing way, you pissant, whatever. And Vickers is embarrassed. And of course, to the cameraman, we'll cut that, right? You know, so... we just see kind of what a putz and how clumsy and a dwarf that he really is. So now we get to the lead up to the sort of start of the op. And it's a full-on military project. There's helicopters and fully armed soldiers. And then there's Vickers, this mid-level manager, to lead it. We see an instance of him trying to serve papers. And it's very cruel and very heartless of what they're trying to do to these aliens. So it's a weird way in this film where our main character, who we're going to follow through the film, the first third of the film, he is a very unsympathetic character, and we really sympathize with the aliens to some degree, because there's no one else on his crew and no one else in the military. I mean, no one is someone we sympathize with. It's really like a gang of vultures here. We see at one point a prawn killing a man because the alien had become upset or frightened about this whole project and the whole presence there, and we see it's put down, killed, so there's already blood on our hands. And then we see Vickers, in a show of his character, that he tries to bribe an alien to sign by offering up a can of cat food, which we're now introduced to is a very highly prized item by the prawns. They can be exploited easily by simply being sold or traded cans of cat food. They'll give pretty much anything for it. And we see Vickers quite nastily exploiting an alien in this way, where it doesn't want to sign, but he, you know, offers it cat food and it signs. We are also shown baby prawns who look like actually oversized shrimp. They have cockfights with their young. And we see one of these fights. And again, everything is just filthy and completely chaotic. The feeling of chaos in this film is very palpable. And it's pretty impressive what the filmmakers were able to pull off. Everything feels so chaotic and out of control and just messy and impossible, you know? And I think for me personally, it's part of what's so hard to watch about this film at times where it's like, oh man, it's too real, you know? At this point, we're now introduced to the Nigerians who are a presence in District 9, and they're sort of the District 9, you know, weapons and, you know, cat food dealers. They also do interspecies prostitution, and they exploit the prawns as much as possible because they want to get the prawns brought with them all this alien weaponry. No one really knows what these guns can do because they are biogenetically designed to only operate if you're a prawn. But the Nigerians are collecting them and buying them or exploiting the aliens with cat food to get these weapons, thinking that at some point they're going to figure out how to either, you know, reverse engineer them or get them to fire. The leader of these is a guy named Obisanjo, and I'm probably not pronouncing it quite correctly, who's an amazing, amazing presence there, played by this actor Eugene Kumbanyiwa. He's really, really a dangerous-looking guy. And, you know, again, even the Nigerians' presence here, very palpable, very believable as these thugs, you know, dealing in weapons and cat food to exploit the aliens. And they're going to have a recurring role to play later in the story as well. So this is their introduction for many things. Vikas and his team find a prawn hatchery, and this is where Vikas is like the lowest in his lowest level of sympathy. It's incredibly gross and dirty inside. And what the aliens do is they get cows, kind of keep them alive and hang them up. And they hook up all these tubes and they drain the blood to feed their little eggs where the little aliens grow, the little prawns. And Vikas gleefully starts pulling the blood syringes out of the sacks, and it's such a horrible, horribly cruel thing. He's killing these little babies and he's smiling, and then as if it's no big deal, and then later on they torch the place. We hear this popping sound, and Vikas gleefully is like, "You hear that sound? You hear that sound? That's the young eggs pop like popcorn," you know, and it's like the ultimate in human cruelty. Like you have absolutely no sympathy, and you hope all these people get wiped out very soon. And the feeling again here is just overwhelming. Squalor, confusion, the impossible task of relocating the refugees and how they're going about it, and the complete lack, it's not complete, but very much lack of ability to communicate cross species. It seems like there is an understanding, or the humans kind of understand what the aliens are saying, and the aliens kind of understand what the humans are saying. And hence that, you know, these aliens are really kind of the lowest class of the alien hierarchy, sort of the, you know, the poor aliens, like E.T.'s poor cousins, right? Just adding to the how real and, you know, brilliant the allegory for this film is. Now we jump to our first scene that's not shot in the documentary style and not part of the doc, but it's the beginning of, you know, how the film starts to become a hybrid. And this is the story on the alien side. And we see two aliens scavenging a scrap heap for tech. And one of them is wearing a red vest. And that alien will be very, I think it's Christopher Johnson. I think they name him. It's kind of ridiculous, right? They find what they're looking for, some piece of alien of their own technology. And they go back to this shack where one of them lives. And we see them finishing up some kind of device that we are told is 20 years in the making. And liquid from the piece of tech they just picked up is used kind of run through this little system of tubes and vibrations and harmonics. It's a marvelously realistic-looking contraption to fill another device, which is this cylinder full of this fluid. And we hear that after 20 years of work, this device is now ready. And they detach the completed device just as Vikas and his team are sort of gathering outside to do a little bit of a raid and have whoever lives in that shack sign the relocation papers. So at this point, the red vest alien kind of sneaks out the back, and the other alien he was with, it's his shack, and he's there. Vikas comes in with the men, and they find the chem lab. They actually find the device that we've been looking at, and we see Vikas push this button on the top of it, and this brown liquid sprays him in the face. He wipes it all off, and he tells the cameraman, like, you know, we're going to cut that later, and then all of a sudden we cut, and he replays the scene as if he had just found the device and that he thinks it might be dangerous, so he puts it in a plastic bag, sticks it in his pocket. And then they bust into another room in that same place, and they find what he describes as the largest weapons cache ever found. And we see, you know, in the great mise-en-scene, hear all of the weapons and everything stacked to the gills in this little shack. Wickus takes one of the alien guns outside, and he's showing it to the yellow-colored alien, who is a friend of the red vest alien, who's on the ground, and it's his shack. And the alien breaks loose and is shot in an incredibly cruel way by Kubus, who's there. His name is Kubus Venter. And he goes up really close, and he just does a coup de grace shot right in the head, and then shoots him a couple of times on the ground. And it's kind of the introduction, really, proper, of Kubus, who's quite the effective bad guy in this film, I have to say. As far as bad guys go, he's good. So then the red-vested alien witnesses the death of his friend, goes home, and this red-vested alien has a child. In their house, we see all kinds of computer equipment, and his son, who's also extremely smart and very skilled as well. And so we have immediate sympathy here as the red-vested alien tells his son about his friend is gone, he's not coming back, and there's a sadness over the death, which you can see in the alien's face, which is very subtle but effective, which is really great. But now Vickus and the posse are right there on the door, and the red-vested alien comes outside. Now, this is funny because he's sharp, so he's reading the fine print. We see in subtitles, because whenever the aliens speak, we see the subtitles on the screen. The alien realizes that there's a 24-hour grace period that they have 24 hours to vacate. So Vickus says to his friend, oh, this is a smart one. And instead, in another cruel scene where you really don't like Vickus, he realizes that the red-vested alien has a son and says, we're going to take your son away if you don't sign. And he goes in. And so there's this, but the red-vested alien will not sign. And then, there's an impasse here. So, but it's broken up by Vickus then going into his house and seeing all this computer equipment. This is all non-standard and it's against the law. So the whole jig is up with the red-vested alien, and then there's the intervention. Vickus starts to throw up because he's starting to be affected by the black fluid that he sprayed on his face. He's so sick, and he doesn't want to deal with the complications right now that he just abandoned the place and say they're going to come back later. So in the confusion of his illness, the red-vested alien gets a break. And now we kind of focus on Vickus as the effects of this goo start to happen. He's eating lunch with his team, and this black fluid starts coming out of his nose. It's gross. And back at MNU headquarters, he's in really bad shape. He's coughing. He's pale. When he's by himself, a fingernail winds up coming off, and then a tooth comes out. It made me think of David Cronenberg's The Fly remake. So then we cut to the Nigerians, and we get a little bit of a voiceover and documentary info about the Nigerians for real. There's this alien mech, which a couple of aliens have brought in to the Nigerians, the Nigerians have bought it for 100 cans of cat food. And they detain one of the aliens as the pair is leaving, and they wind up chopping it to pieces up for parts. A very brutal scene. Again, very realistic. And then the documentary kind of gives us the information that they're obsessed with consuming and eating, alien body parts, believing that they're going to be cures to various diseases. And they also have all this weaponry, and they believe that partially consuming these remains will give them, will change them in some ways to allow them to use the weapons. To date, we're told by the documentary's speakers that they have not been successful. And of course, as the film is showing us, they're partially correct in their approach, but they're really a bunch of bad, scary guys. They do this thing now where Vickus comes home, and he's just in such bad shape. Then he walks in the house, and it's dark, and it's a surprise party for him. And everyone's there, and they're greeting him, and he's about to pass out, and he looks awful. And his wife's father, his father-in-law, corners him in the kitchen about the aliens that were shot that day, and he berates him for his failure. He's like, you're going to mess this up for me. I'll look for somebody else, you loser. He's such a horrible guy. That you can't get the job done, I'll get someone who will. And, we don't care because Vickus is just such a scumbag at this point. So as the party rolls on, there's one point where he's standing by his birthday cake and he just vomits black bile all over the cake and the cupcakes. And he takes a thing and starts to pat it to sop it up, and then he collapses. Really gross scene.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Well, we still use money in the 21st century, unfortunately. I'd just like to take a quick moment to let you know some ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. Patreon is a crowdfunding site where you can sign up and you can donate to Sci-Fi on Screen per podcast. So as little as like a dollar per show, you can go up, signing up as a snap. And the way it works is every time I upload a podcast, it would debit your account that amount. So, dollar a show would be, like $1 every 2 weeks, $2 a month, you do the math. If you wanted to do a one-time donation, you could go to paypal.com and under scifionscreen at gmail.com, you can donate one time there. And non-monetary ways you can contribute is to tweet the show, share the show on Facebook, and or write a review on iTunes. Also, my archive shows now are all available for 99 cents a show on my website, scifionscreen.com. I have about 80-plus archive shows there, and there's a page on my website. It's called Archived Shows Alphabetically, and you can just pick the show you like, take a look, and you can download it for 99 cents. So you can also do that as well.
Tell them, Jim.
Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim.
Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim.
And then we cut to the hospital. So he's there, and the doctor's there taking his temperature, and there was a hand that was damaged by the alien that had tried to get away in one of the confrontations in District 9, and he bandaged up his hand. And now the doctor removes the bandage, and we see this complete alien claw emerge from the bandage. His hand has completely transformed into this large claw, and it's really great. It looks really gross and real in the scene, and he's sedated. And this is the own military, the MMU, sponsored military, come in and take him. And now at this point, we're transitioning into kind of the hybrid of this feature film footage, and there's also documentary stuff when we need some kind of background information. But the feature transitioning is kind of well on its way. It seems it's very seamless to me. I think the first time you would have had a problem with it was when you were with the aliens on the garbage heap looking for tech. When you realized you weren't in a documentary anymore, the production values were higher, and everything just was like, oh, we're watching a movie now. And those scenes come in more and more, so it's brilliant how they did it. Now, and it's a triumph of editing, really. They were able to now blend a feature's production values in with this documentary style, and they go side by side, so it's really great. So that now is when Vickers gets his comeuppance, and they wheel him into an alien, really, a body shop, a chop shop, where basically the military has been experimenting on aliens to try to figure out a way to get the guns to fire. And they start experimenting on him, and he can use the alien weapons with his hand. So they bring in an alien and have the alien stand in front of him, and he doesn't want to do it. He pulls the trigger, and these alien weapons are so powerful, they literally blow bodies apart so that meat and viscera kind of go flying everywhere. And he's crying, and he doesn't want to kill the aliens, and they force him to keep pulling the trigger. And his wife's father is there, so we really get the idea now that his wife's father knows exactly what's going on. And the brutality of the testing is really extreme. They treat him like a piece of meat, like a really an unperson, and they talk around him and not to him. We hear the heads of the research division now talking about the alien DNA in his body and how at this point in the transformation, it's kind of perfectly fused, but if they don't act now to harvest all of his body parts, he'll eventually turn into a prawn and they'll lose their chance. So they're all standing around him as he's on this gurney, and they're just like, should we just kill him? And the doctor's like, well, we need it all. We need the head, the heart, everything. And they know it would represent billions in bioweapons research. And it's a really chilling moment. You know, the thing about torture is, you know, some people think about pain. They look at torture as like, oh, I could probably take that pain, or I couldn't take that pain. And it's not necessarily the pain, but, you know, not knowing when and if the torturer is ever going to stop inflicting it, you know, being in the hands of people who are not treating you like a human being, right? And I think that terror of torture probably outweighs the pain a zillion times, that existential terror of, like, I'm completely sequestered and in the power of people who view me in a sort of subhuman way. And it's done so well here that, and it's great for Vickers' character because now he's getting a real dose of what he's been doing to the aliens and what they've all been doing to the aliens for years, treating them like meat. And it's a great plot device to have him turn into an alien, you know, to have him experience what the other side is like. Great in an allegorical way and perfect in this kind of a film. They talk casually about cutting out his heart. And in this moment, the father-in-law is home with the daughter like, oh, you know, I don't think he's going to pull through. He was never much of a fighter. He's dying in the hospital. Meanwhile, he knows that they're going to cut him to pieces. It's a very chilling cut back and forth. And at one point, when they're about to cut into his chest, and Charlton Copley's amazing here. I mean, he's really, really good. Terrified and scared and angry and screaming. It's an amazing scene. But he gets loose before they can cut into him, and there's this battle in the operating room, and he kind of gets away. And now we get a subtitle on the screen, 31 hours after exposure. And Vickers realizes that, you know, the complete turnaround now is the only place he can truly be safe is in District 9. So he returns there. We see him stealing a cell phone from a passerby, and he tries to call home, but his mother-in-law intercepts the call and won't put his wife on the line. So then we get the documentary cuts in and tells us that he has now become the most valuable person on the planet, wanted by every weapons manufacturer ever, because he alone, of all people ever, could operate alien weaponry. And so there's this brief scene where he's trying to get some food at a fast food stall, and the story about him comes on TV, and what MMU has done is done a smear campaign, and they're showing pictures that he's wanted because they're accusing him of having prolonged sex with the aliens, and that he's carrying virulent diseases. And so everyone in the hamburger place looks right at him and runs out of the way. And he's shot at by the manager, you know, so he has become completely an outcast now. And now it's really gross. He wakes up one morning in some abandoned shack in District 9. He eats some cat food. More of his teeth are coming out. References from me to The Fly. And I think all the movies that Blomkamp quoted as his inspiration, The Fly, fits right in that mix big time. His wife calls him on that cell phone, basically going to divorce him and going to end it with him, with having the sex with aliens news story. She breaks it off on the phone. And now, you know, Vic is completely and utterly bereft. And Copley really is tremendous here. He steals an axe and he tries to cut off his hand. He only succeeds in cutting off one of the fingers. Then this fleet of helicopters approaches looking for him. And he finds his way into the hut of the red-vested alien. And he begs to be helped. And in that moment, all the computers come online. And he sees a trunk line going from the hut down into a hole. And then he passes out. So once the red-vested alien sees his hand, he realizes that he must have had contact with the fluid. And they hide him. And so when he comes to, he's in this small craft that's underground. And it was the original craft that had fallen off the larger ship way in the beginning. We had that little mystery there about what had happened to the craft. We get all the information now. The alien realizes that the fluid is necessary to power the dropship to get it up to the mothership. And then they're able to finally leave in the mothership. He can take all the aliens back on board and leave Earth. It's been 20 years in the planning. There's no more of that fluid around, so it's that fluid or not. And then in the throwaway line, the red-vested alien says, you know, we could have fixed you too. Tells Vickers that there's technology on the ship that can reverse the process that's been happening to him and bring him back to humanity. So, of course, now, you know, we're setting up for the big third act here, that they need the fluid in the lab back at MMU. Vickers has to get it. So in that moment, he's not sure if he can do it. We see him alone. There's some real body horror moments here as he takes off his shirt and we see half his body transforming into these gross, kind of black, superating lesions. They're really, really gross looking. And right here in this moment, he completely breaks down. And Copley does a great moment where when we hear him cry, there's something that breaks in him. It's a very honest, very lonely, mournful way of crying that happens just for a brief moment where we know that he's hit rock bottom. And at that moment, his wife calls, confused, but saying, listen, I just want everything to go back the way it was. I still love you. So he's now committed to action that if he can reverse this process, you know, that he can get his life back. So we've got sort of the motivation for what's to come. Now he needs weapons for the assault on MNU. So he visits the Nigerians. They take his money. We don't know where he got money, but he has money. And they're about to kill him when the leader notices that his arm has been transformed and he wants it. So Vickers doesn't understand what they're saying, but we see the subtitles on the screen that they're going to chop his arm off. But in the melee, he grabs an alien weapon, which, of course, works with him. And we see the muzzle of the weapon. It's a very large kind of a stun-type weapon. The weapons are really cool in this film. They're really designed in great ways. They look like alien weapons, really. And he grabs one. It's like maybe a 8-inch, 10-inch muzzle, and we see the energy inside of it activate, so we know that he's able to manipulate it. And the force stun blows a couple of Nigerians just back out of the place. It's really neat. So he gets out, he kind of holds them at gunpoint now. They give him all kind of the weapons that he needs, but the head of the Nigerians is like, I'm coming for you, you know. You better kill me now, because I'm coming for you. I want that arm, you know. He's just such a bad dude. So now, from now until the end of the film, we're completely escalated into nonstop action and tension. We cut right to NNU headquarters where Wickes punches a hole through the wall with one of the weapons. And so he and the red-vested alien are in holding guns. Whenever they kill the soldiers blow apart like a, you know, like imagine a cow blowing apart. Just meat and guts everywhere. Very powerful, cool looking alien weapons. The one Vickers has especially kind of shoots lightning. It's just really wild. He still knows the codes to all the places that he needs to get, being an employee there. And he finally finds the cylinder after a brief firefight. So they have the cylinder. We see the red-vested alien looking at one of the aliens now that's been in that chop shop area. And he's realizing now, I guess the aliens didn't really understand what was happening to some of their members. And so he realizes now that, and we see the aliens all burnt up and charred and horrible, that, you know, the humans have been experimenting on them and torturing them. And the alien's visibly shaken. We can see that. And it's really neat. So now there's a tense firefight as Kubis comes on the scene with a bunch of his guys. And Vickers keeps blowing guys completely apart with his weapon, with that alien gun. The red-vested alien makes a makeshift bomb from a couple of weapons that he's found. And it gets them back outside and into a vehicle. They get to the this climax now as they go make their way back towards the underground ship. They have the cylinder. So they get back to the ship and they're about to go. During the pre-launch prep, the red-vested alien tells Vickers that it's going to be 3 years before I can really fix you. And he said he's changed his mind and that now that he sees the medical experiments that are going on, he needs to take the ship back to his home world to get reinforcements to come back to free all his people, because now he realizes that it's possible that the humans aren't going to let them go. And so Vickers kind of freaks out and in a rage, knocks him unconscious, and he takes the fluid from him. The red-vested alien is up top, unconscious in the shack, and Kubis busts in with his gunman, and he's about to kind of start beating on him when Vickers activates the ship, because he had been shown by the little boy, you know, where the fluid goes and, you know, what's going to happen to the ship. So now we see from a helo camera, which is great. We're kind of back in documentary footage, the shuttle, the ship rising up, you know, coming up out of the shack and heading towards the mothership. But Kubis and his whole team, they shoot rockets at it and the ship crashes. And now we see the red-vested alien react. His dream is dead. The ship is down. And he's taken prisoner. And Vickers is then pulled from the ship as the red-vested alien's son watches from inside. So they don't know about the son yet. Now there's this moment where all is lost, and the Nigerians attack with trucks and RPGs, and it's complete chaos. It's the MNR troops versus the Nigerians, and it's just complete chaos, and it's nuts. And Vickers is taken by the Nigerians now, who still want his arm. But the MNR troops are descending on them now, so they're still battling. There's great cutbacks between things, and things are so chaotic here. But at the same time, Christopher's son, who's smarter, the red-vested alien's son, who's smarter than the red-vested alien himself kind of knew, taps into the power of the mothership remotely and turns it on. So that shaking and that rattling as the mothership kind of wakes up after 20 years. And at the same time, he takes control of an armored mech, the one that the Nigerians bought off of those aliens, and turns it on. And it comes alive and kills all the Nigerians, saving Vickers. And then suddenly the mothership moves slightly and all the helicopters are now surrounding it. So, you know, it's on. Kubis and the MNR troops start torturing the red-vested alien about the ship. You know all about it. And, you know, we just know that Kubis is just going to torture this poor thing to death. Vickers, since he can operate alien weaponry, climbs into the mech. And it's really, the mech looks really neat. All the CGI in the film is really seamless. There's never a moment when I think I'm looking at CGI. You know, it's really incredibly done. So this mech is great. At first, he sees that Christopher's about to be tortured to death. He sees that the red-vested alien is going to be tortured to death, runs away with the mech, and then he stops at one point, and we close in on him, and he turns around. So finally, you know, Vickers has been redeemed as a character, you know, because that's the moment when it's not all about him. He was racing towards the mothership to somehow get aboard, if possible, but now he turns back to help someone else and possibly jeopardize his own chances. So we have the kind of redemption of Vickers here, which is great. And so now we get this great battle as this mech fights its way through District 9 to try to reunite the red-vested alien with the little boy. And it's great battle sequences here. There's a sniper from a distance that, you know, and the mech's taking damage too. It's not like a super weapon that can't be hurt. But Vickers is doing some serious damage with it. And it's like, you know, if you've ever played a video game where you get into a mech and you start, you know, going to town on soldiers that aren't used to you being in a mech, it's fun. So it's kind of fun to watch him kind of go nuts. Very good battles here. Very Saving Private Ryan kind of realism to all the stuff that's going on. The mech is slowly breaking down and taking tons and tons of damage. And then in the middle of this, when the mech is almost done, the son starts the tractor beam, and the red-vested alien now is in the little shuttle, and the son has figured out a way to use the tractor beam to lift the shuttle. So the son and the red-vested alien are in the shuttle. The tractor beam from the mothership is lifting them into the ship, and of course, Kubris is like, bring it down, bring it down. And there was an RPG meant for the ship, kind of probably the last one while it was still in range. Vickis grabs it, downs it, and it blows up, but he's pretty much done. A truck backs into him and takes him out. Vickis is then completely alone and vulnerable, and Kubris is there, ready to take him out. He cocks his gun. Then a whole group of aliens approach, a whole group of prawns approach to protect him, and Kubris is able to kill one, but he's completely torn apart by the rest of them. So Vickis, at the end, you know, in saving the red-vested alien and his son, you know, seem to earn the respect at least of the aliens, and so they save him at the end. We see the alien mothership ascend, and it activates, and it's gone. Then back to kind of documentary saw footage. Vickis has disappeared. No one knows where he is. We get the end of the documentary footage of everyone who knows him, how he's vanished. And one of the men who was with Vickis when he was speaking up against the sort of in the documentary, one of Vickis's ex-workmates actually spoke up in his defense, and you know some of the things about the MMR, about how cruel they were, and he was jailed now because of it, so he's been put away. And there's a whole, you know, resettlement to District 10, which is still going to happen. And then we see this last shot of a prawn, which is Vickis, and he is completely transformed. There was a time earlier before he completely transformed where he had one alien eye and one human eye when he looked really cool, and now he's completely unrecognizable as a human. He is a prawn, and we're out. So, man, District 9, just to summarize briefly, it's a crackerjack story. The brutality and the realism of it really just are very astonishing. The CGI all throughout, to me, is very seamless. The bad guy, Kubris, is great. And all the military stuff, just everything has such a sense of realism to it. It's really astonishing. And it's all cloaked in this political allegory that is as relevant today as it was when the movie was filmed, if not more so. So it's an amazing, you know, combination of Peter Jackson producing and Blomkamp directing. They really, really hit it out of the park. I mean, District 9 is one of the greatest sci-fi films in the 21st century, I would say. Very up near the top five, I think, of the best five ever done, starting in the year 2000. Really a brilliant film all throughout. You know, I hope at some point Blomkamp returns to this world. He's done two films after this. He did a film called Elysium, which I saw and had the same kind of texture and tone that District 9 had, with a lot more money on the screen, but I wasn't really bowled over by the story. I thought it was kind of a boring one-note story. It really didn't interest me. I need to revisit it for sure, but I'm not a huge fan of Elysium. And then Chappie, which was sort of his artificial intelligence in the guise of a robot, you know, robot's sort of evolution, which I didn't, you know, when I walked away from it thinking that it was tonally kind of a mess and didn't really respond to it that much. But I mean, there was a lot of care into its making. It was an interesting film. It was very hard to watch in some places, as this robot is taken by this drugged out kind of ghetto family, and that's its upbringing. You know, like, I think in story conversations, they probably said, hey, what if HAL 9000 got downloaded into a robot and was raised by, like, you know, the Manson family or something, you know? Interesting idea, but very odd kind of payoff for Chappie. So, you know, he has been trying to get an Alien sequel together, and what he wanted to do was sort of erase Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection and make a direct sequel to Aliens, bringing back Michael Biehn, Sigourney Weaver, and possibly the actress who played young Newt. That was going forward until Ridley Scott jumped on board and decided to go crazy. We're making all these Alien prequels. He's going to make like four of them. And there's something about what Ridley's doing with the Alien prequels that directly contradicts or may get in the way of Blomkamp doing the Alien, you know, the next set of stories in the Alien universe. So that's been in development hell. I don't know what he's plan on doing next, but you know, there's definitely, obviously, District 9, right? It ends on kind of a cliffhanger. The aliens are gone, and the red-vested alien is going to bring back sort of, you know, brethren to save their kind from the clutches of us human beings, and what that would be like. That would be more of a full-on alien invasion pick. But I guess, you'd have to break the story, because it would have to be a unique and interesting story, not just, you know, another alien invasion movie, District 9 style. You'd have to figure out something. But yeah, so District 9, really, really very tough film for me to watch. Probably not a film that I'm going to watch a lot in my life. But when I do watch it, I'm always impressed by it. But there are parts of the film that make it so hard to watch because it's too real in a weird way that it's hard for me to do repeat viewings and be completely pleasured by it. You know, it always pushes me out to consider other things and make me feel kind of uncomfortable about what it's trying to show me, which I think is exactly what they wanted to do. So a really, really good film that, you know, deserves to be pretty high up in the pantheon as we go. So that's all I've got to say about District 9. I will see you next time.